Hello. Surely you know by now that this is Off Grid with me, Void.
And me, Dave.
Where we pick three words out of a cryptic crossword to verbally throw at each other and enjoy the ricochets.
Don't worry, you don't need to have solved the puzzle to follow along with our chat, but if you do want to, this episode we've solved Picaroon's puzzle from The Guardian on the 24th of February 2024, which is puzzle 29314. And so if you don't want spoilers, stop the pod and go solve it before you come back.
Some words that were grabbed from Off the Grid will also inspire a mini-quiz hosted by the reliably excellent General Knowledge. Pip, Pip, General?
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Welcome back.
It's good to be here.
We also pick one favourite clue from the puzzle each, but you don't have to understand them, as we said. We'll be explaining the clues as we go along. Let's dive straight in with one of those. Dave?
Right, I picked 24 across, which said, what metal dealer did without energy to persevere? And you're looking for a 7 and 2. So you can have a think about that, or not, your choice. Either way, I'll explain how it works after we've heard from the general. So which word in the puzzle caught your eye and why?
The word that I chose was Fermi. And I have to admit, I had to look it up just to check. I got it from the wordplay, but I thought, Fermi, what is it? I can tell you, in the dictionary, it tells you that it is a unit equal to 10 to the minus 15 metres. But obviously, the clue refers to the scientist who that is named after, whose name is Enrico Fermi. Mm-hmm. I was the only person in my family who had never heard of Enrico Fermi, which is embarrassing. Okay. Other members of my family are 14 and 17, but there you go. So I thought, oh, that's great. Sure to be an interesting guy. He's got this thing named after him. He's actually got lots of things named after him. But I have to admit, I didn't really like him.
Ooh. Okay.
It turns out to be a bit of a misogynist. I mean, you can't see me for that. He's been dead a while. But also, I haven't watched Oppenheimer yet. And I felt that we'd be full of spoiler alerts because, yes, he was someone with Jewish relations. He was born in Europe and fled to America and ended up working on the Manhattan Project. And so anyway, I'm going to move on from that to the Fermi paradox.
Aha.
Do you know the Fermi paradox?
Oh,
this is where is everybody, isn't it? I think
it is. It's where is everybody? Apparently he said this after at a lunch with fellow physicists where they'd sort of been chatting about recent reports of UFOs and the possibilities of travel faster than the speed of light. And he obviously pondered this throughout the lunch and eventually went, where is everybody? So in other words, if life is so easy, someone from somewhere should have come calling by now.
Yeah.
Is the Fermi paradox. So if you obviously just from the Milky Way, there's like 20 billion sun-like stars and a fifth of them have an Earth-like planet around it. So if only say 0.1% had life emerging. When you consider that some of them are millions and millions of years older than the Earth, and then you assume that everything keeps progressing and progressing and progressing, just someone should have visited by now. Where is everybody?
Yeah.
Anyway, this led me to thinking about UFO sightings, and I found a tale that did entertain me, and I'm going to share that with you now, if that's okay.
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 So it's the morning of Monday, the 4th of September, 1967. And along the 51st parallel from Clevedon to Isle of Sheppey, six alien-looking silver objects are found. They emit a strange, ominous hum and evoke puzzlement and fear in those that discovered them. As the findings are reported to police, the apparent flying saucers are cordoned off and the public moved away as the army are called in to assist. The saucer on Sheppey is removed by RAF helicopter. Satellite experts head to Newbury to investigate a bleeping, hissing object full of mysterious liquid. the army blow up the one in Chippenham. I should point out that the sources, by the way, were very evenly spaced along that latitude.
Okay, yeah.
Another was sent to the Atomic Weapons Establishment and one to the Guided Weapons Division of BAC. And it wasn't until Scotland Yard the bomb disposal squad bought portable X-ray equipment to Bromley Police Station, where another of the sources was, that it was revealed to be a hoax. The ever-ready batteries were somewhat of a giveaway. So the hoax was a ragweeks prank by a group of apprentices and students from the Royal Aircraft Establishment in nearby Farnborough Technical College. From the moment they had come up with the idea, they were absolutely determined this was going to be convincing. They watched a lot of sci-fi.
And they I'm did, just surprised I haven't heard of this already, because this all sounds quite new to me. It's good.
BBC did a however many years later thing, not that long ago. So if you look at, you will look it up, I'm sure. They do actually look like sort of movie flying saucers. So they really wanted to make sure there wasn't anything recognisably human. There should be no aerials or portholes or other sort of like terrestrial inventions. So they made use plaster molds. They created these saucer things, covered them in metal and sandwiched them together with some electronic sound equipment and a flour and water mix inside. The sound equipment was activated when they inverted the saucer. So that switched it on and it started making those humming noises. So that night before.
So when they crashed or landed, they'd start bleeping.
Yeah, so they sent out 16.
Whatever poor sap found them.
So, and the flour and water mix would ferment inside to make a rather unpleasant smelling slime. And the hoax they did, well, they said afterwards that they really intended for the invasion to be taken seriously. It was a time, it was Sputnik, space exploration, and sort of like almost daily UFO sightings. And they wanted to see how the government would respond to an alien invasion.
Which year did you say it was?
1967.
Oh, 67. Okay, yes.
67. So obviously they were not impressed with the response, with the blowing up and everything. In fact, one of the saucers was drilled into by police, and because it was full of compacted sort of soft papier-mâché mess, it exploded, sharing the police officers with this foul-smelling slime, which they did not test for radioactivity or any other hazardous material. They literally just showered it down the drain into the public water system. Anyway, despite the hoax being discovered the same day, the UFO invasion made headlines around the world. It was literally front page in Australia, America, and the publicity helped students raise £2,000 for their Ragweek charity raising, which in today's money is over £45,000, so not bad.
That's pretty good.
And I can bring this back to Fermi. He was a huge practical joker, apparently. And pleased to say, the students didn't get expelled or prosecuted for this, and Fermi managed to narrowly escape after getting expelled for his pranking.
Oh, he did.
That's the story I found that I thought, that's really interesting. I will share that.
That's quite good, that, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. I've not heard that before. There's a few UFO stories pop up on a different podcast, the Uncanny podcast, which is mostly about ghosts.
Danny something.
Yes, Robbins.
Robbins, yeah.
Which is, I think he has made a very entertaining podcast. A very good piece of entertainment he's got there. That's where.
So, what do you think UFOs are real? Do you think they are actually coming?
I think there are things that fly that are unidentified. We've touched on the Drake equation before, which I suppose is an attempt to answer the Fermi paradox. And that's where he says if there are so many stars and so many of them are of this type and so many of them have planets around them and so many of those planets are in the Goldilocks zone and so many of those evolve life, etc., etc., and you keep breaking it down and comes up with an attempt to work out the probability of intelligent life existing somewhere. It's a best guess for each of the terms in that equation. So,
yeah, so the levels of God, I can't think of the words that I'm looking for. Sorry.
Certainty?
Kind of the opposite of uncertainty.
I tend to agree with the where are they all question in much the same way that was it Stephen Hawking through a party for time travellers and sent out the invitations 6 months after the party had happened and no one showed up. So.
Turned up. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's the other thing, isn't it? Is the if time travel would be possible at all at any point? Why haven't we seen travellers from the future?
Yeah.
Personally, I don't think it's a great sign that we haven't seen any aliens, because it sort of tends to suggest that you don't keep developing and developing and developing, and you're always going to reach some sort of life ending.
A catastrophe point.
Before you get to that stage,
either
maybe.
That or they've all looked at us and gone, no, steer clear at that point. That's
terrible. Yeah, looking around, I think we could easily wipe ourselves out.
Yeah, I think both of those scenarios are equally plausible. Yeah.
I've heard that 50% of the population are of below average intelligence.
But that's another. Is it a paradox? What's the name of the guy who's had the thing where the less able to understand things you are, the less able you are to realise that you don't understand them?
The Dunning-Kruger effect.
Which is probably good.
The stupid people don't know they're stupid. Yeah.
I said able to understand. I didn't use pejorative.
Well, yeah, this is vernacular. I'm sorry.
That was primary school teacher me. Still working towards. That's what we say.
Still working towards.
Working towards putting his coat on the right way around.
It's lucky our listeners are all in the top 50%, though, isn't it?
And if they're not.
Well, if they're not, they must be happy.
I definitely think they are.
Yes. Cool. Yeah. All right, Dave, do you want to explain your clue now?
Yeah. Okay. If you remember, it was what metal dealer did without energy to persevere. So that without energy bit, at first sight, you think, oh, it's a deletion clue. You're going to start with something that a metal dealer did, and you're going to delete E for energy and get something meaning to persevere. And then you realize or remember that without, as well as meaning lacking, can also mean on the outside of. So it's not a deletion, it's an addition. You're sticking an E into something a metal dealer did. And then that way you can get from sold iron, after shuffling the word space a bit, to soldier on. I thought that was quite neat.
Yeah.
I agree. I also thought it was quite neat.
Anyway, what was your choice of clue?
My choice was 21 across. Idiot admitting a case of malpractice in court. And I chose that because I love the surface.
Okay.
I'll tell you how it works later.
Yes.
Seven letters, listeners.
Yeah, seven letters.
In the meantime, Void, what about your choice of word? What leapt off the page for you?
I picked the word cabaret out of the grid. I don't know if I've mentioned it before, but I'm a juggler.
Oh, you didn't know?
Yeah, oh, right, okay.
Oh, fascinating.
Some years back, I had a regular job for a few seasons working in corporate Christmas cabarets. We'd be entertaining folks at their works Christmas do, either one large company for the evening or several smaller companies would book out a table. And the theme was Cossacks. There were several Cossack dancers, maybe an acrobat or two, a couple of jugglers, hello, and a strongman.
Okay.
And we would do a few short routines on platform stages in the bar area as people arrived. And then there'd be a few big musical numbers on the main stage while dinner was being served to the guests.
Right.
Sounds lovely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good evening out.
Do come along in the past.
With your time machine.
Yes.
Yeah.
We jugglers had our own bits to perform and we joined in the big numbers too. But we also had to be the sidemen during the strongman act.
Did the strongman have one of those kind of stripy tops and things?
Now, I had made a note to say here that we are not talking about a comedy Victorian strongman with a fuzzy moustache and a bendy rubber barbell.
That was my picture in my head as well.
And a hollow one-ton weight. No, he had real heavy metal props. Heavy metal props, if you like. Big balls that he juggled, kettlebells, a huge chain with really heavy weights on the end, which he had spin around.
Do you know this?
A massive sledgehammer.
I mean, did you actually pick them
up? Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. And he had a big barbell as well.
Just checking.
Yeah, our job during his act is as he finished with one set of props, he'd put them down and we just had to shuffle them off the stage. get them out of the way while he moved on to his next bit.
You know for a fact.
Yes, Oleg is a very strong bloke, and he had seriously big, well, muscles and props.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he told us that a common reaction he gets is people coming up to him after his acts and saying, "Oh, they're not really heavy, are they?" Or asking to feel how heavy they were. You know, "Oh, I can lift it up, mate. Go on, give it a go." And that this could get a bit tedious for him, which I can understand. But also throw it back to another episode when we were talking about people wanting to say something to a performer but not really knowing what to say, how to engage the conversation, so they just blurt out the most obvious thing to say.
Yes, this was when you were talking about stilt walking, wasn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, one year that this show was on, the stage was set up in the round. And during Oleg's act, me and my juggling pal stood outside just on the edge of the ring stage. And the audience were sat at tables, some of them pretty close to where we were stood, just about 6 feet away, the nearest table.
Mm-hmm.
And my job at one point was to lift one of the kettlebells up from the edge of the stage, which was about mid-chest height, that's where I was standing, and drop it down onto Oleg's prop platform on the floor. It was fairly heavy. I can't remember exactly how heavy. I'm going to say 20 kilograms, maybe. And I could do this, okay, without too much trouble. I mean, all I had to do is pick it up and lower it down. A few centimetres up and then a metre down. So it was
doable. Yeah.
Fine. I didn't have to throw it around and juggle with it like Oleg was doing. So it was doable. But bearing in mind what he'd told us about audience reaction, and given that some people were sitting so close to where I was standing, I made it look as if the kettlebell was a bit heavier than it was, as if I had to struggle with it a little bit, just to reinforce the point in the minds of the audience who are closest to me. Now, all of that is the setup.
Okay.
Right.
This happened in a year when I'd just got my first video camera. And so I was filming all the acts over the course of a few evenings. And I ended up making a website for Oleg and putting the video of his act on it, with his permission, obviously.
Yeah.
This was in the mid-noughties, back when sometimes I would bother looking at the stats of my website to see where visitors were coming to my website from, via what links and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One day I noticed that someone arrived at the site via a bodybuilding forum. And I thought, hey, that's funny, what's that all about? And so I clicked through, because I didn't realise or notice that they'd gone to Oleg's page on my website, so I've got lots of pages. Because kettlebells are often used by bodybuilders, they'd found the keyword kettlebell, come across Oleg's page, and they were discussing his act, the kettlebell bit, and how heavy they thought it was. And one of them said, "Oh, I think it's X kilograms." I can't remember what the guess was. But then someone else said, "No, it must be heavier than that. Check out the stagehand 2 minutes into the video. He's really struggling to lift it off of the stage." Lol. And so they had a good laugh at my expense, which I was completely fine with, because I thought, I've done my job.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They'd give me an award for my acting.
Oh.
Yeah, right.
Well done.
Thank you. I would like to say hello to Oleg on the off chance that he's listening, and also to his son Daniel, who has taken up the family business and now performs as a strong man himself.
Oh,
that's amazing.
Yeah. Link in the blog, folks, if you want to watch Oleg's act or see me overacting in the background.
Very good.
All right, General, do you want to explain how your favourite clue works, please?
Okay, yes, of course. So, as well as loving the surface, I also liked the idiot. The idiot is a clot, which I think is a great word. And then the A is just A, and ME is case of malpractice. But obviously, as a whole thing, it makes a very believable surface. And Camelot Court, of course, yes.
Yeah, very good. My favourite clue was two down. like Heart of Hobart, potentially. Six letters. Which I will explain after Dave tells us something.
Right. Well, I was taken by the word entr'acte at seven down. That's E-N-T-R, apostrophe A-C-T-E. It's literally French for between acts. So this is a piece of music or another performance played during an intermission or an interval.
Yeah.
Now, you think in the theatre, you've obviously got several reasons for having an interval. You know, looking at the idea from both front of house and back of house, you give the audience a chance to stretch their legs, visit the toilet, hopefully go out to the bar or the foyer and spend some money on drinks and snacks.
Ice creams,
yeah.
I was thinking ice creams as well, immediately.
Yeah, but perhaps more significantly, you're giving the cast a chance to visit their toilets as well as costume changes and the significant scenery changes and things like that. But what about in the cinema? The average length of a film has fluctuated a lot over the years, but the general trend is upwards.
Mm. Yeah, there's a reason I haven't seen Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
It's very, very long.
It's around 100 minutes in the 1940s was your average. Went up to 110 in the 1980s. It's more like 120 minutes now. And yet, movies used to have an interval, but now, at least in the UK and the US, they generally don't.
There's a quote, isn't there, which perhaps you're coming on to. It's from a film director. I can't remember which one, and it goes something like the length of an average movie should not exceed the length of a person's bladder. What's the word? Insurance.
Something like
yeah.
Insurance of a person. Yeah. No, I wasn't going to come on to that, okay. But yeah. So obviously in the cinema, you don't have that need for the cast and the crew to take a break. So is the audience and the concession sales the only reason?
I can't think. Which films I've seen with a break. Pulp Fiction had a break.
Oh, well, when I was working in a cinema, which was many, many years ago, Born on the 4th of July had an intermission.
I can think of a reason. 2001
Space Odyssey.
There are lots of websites that are saying that the last film that the Americans generally had an intermission in was Gandhi, which was 1982. What were you thinking, Void?
That was a bit of an epic as well, if I remember. A fairly long one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking the projectionist needs to be involved.
Well, it's certainly something to do with that, yeah. I've got, I mean, everybody knows who knows me knows that I'm into film music, and I've got a number of soundtrack albums that include an entr'acte in the score. And one of those might give a clue, and that's Seven Wonders of the World as seen in the greatest wonder of Cinerama. So, yeah, it's projector technology. It's how long a reel of film you can fit on a projector. So if you think in the very early days of cinema, you could only fit a single reel on a projector, and so you needed an interval at the end of each reel to give time for the projectionist to lace up the next one.
Yeah.
Later on, they developed a system using two projectors side by side, and you'd have reel one on the first projector and reel two on the second projector, and there would be holes cut in the film near the end of one reel, which would make a momentary spot of white on the screen. You may remember films used to have a little kind of white flash in the corner.
Yeah, I can definitely remember going to see films in the cinema and having my train of thought or following the plot of the film interacted by a little flash or a little pause or stutter as the reels were changed over.
Yeah, so the little white flash was a sort of a cue for the projectionist to get the second one up and running, and then at the last flash, as it were, he'd slide a lens cover across, blocking the beam from the first projector, unblocking the second one, and he'd switch the sound source from one to the other. So hopefully you'd get a smooth transition and an unbroken viewing experience for the audience.
I hadn't thought about one device being slid across from the front of one camera lens to the other. Makes sense, really, rather than having to put a lens cap onto one and take one off of the other.
Yeah. But the thing is, you then get fancy specialist film formats that need both projectors at the same time. like 3D, mm-hmm. You've got one projector projecting the red image and one the blue or green image on top of one another. Or super widescreen formats like Cinerama, where you've got two or even three projectors playing their images side by side.
I'd never realised that multiple projectors were used at the same time for any formats. I never thought about it.
Cinerama, curved screen, and you had three projectors. Yeah.
Wow.
So in those situations, you would have to go back to having an interval so that you could lace up the next reel.
Right, yeah.
As a slight aside, 100 years ago, in 1924, the avant-garde French artist Francis Picabia, I'm not sure about the pronunciation of his surname, to be honest with you, but I'm guessing that, and the composer Eric Satie, between them produced a ballet that was called Relâche, which was a sort of Dadaist joke. It's the equivalent of calling a show closed or cancelled.
Okay.
So that when you put it on the poster, people are like, oh, is this on or not?
Guys, do you want to make money or not?
Well, quite.
But it's art.
And they commissioned a young up-and-coming filmmaker called René Clair to produce a short film for the interval.
Okay.
That film was a 22-minute surrealist thing whose cast included Picabia and Satie and Claire and Marcel Duchamp and Man Ray. Mm. So you can see it was kind of a surrealist thing. It was called Entr'acte.
Uh-huh.
And it was one of the last compositions of Eric Satie, who died in 25. I have got it on CD and it's...
Interesting?
Not an easy listen, let's put it this way.
Okay.
It's a very repetitive four-note motif that quite quickly gets rather annoying. And I wonder whether perhaps the whole idea of it was to drive the audience out of the auditorium to go and get a drink. I don't know.
Depends whether you wanted them to come back again or not.
Well, yeah, as well. Has that music stopped yet? Yeah, okay. Okay, give us the answer and parting of that clue that you read out.
Well, before I do that, I'll just say that I remember coming across the word Entr'acte somewhere, and I'd never seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I've never seen that word. I don't know what it means. But I know what it means, because I learned a bit of French in school between the acts. It's a very obvious word to work out.
Yeah.
While we're on it, I had an amazing tour the British Film Institute. You get to go backstage, so you actually go into the IMAX screening room. Those reels are enormous.
Yeah.
And you get to go into one of the old screening rooms, which is, like you said, they still show old movies there, so they have all the facilities to show the ones which burst into flames if you treat them wrongly. But if you're ever in London, recommend it.
Okay. Give us a sense of scale then. How enormous is enormous?
The thing is, you're not here. Because I'm holding my arms right out and I could probably just about maybe pick it up. And I think they were saying that Oppenheimer only just made it onto the one reel. Although I think they show a lot of it on digital as well. But it was
That's another reason why you don't have intervals these days, because of the switch from film to digital. And there's no kind of capacity limits, just as big as the hard drive is, really.
Yeah.
They gave us little bits of IMAX film as well. It's quite wide compared to normal film as well.
It is, yeah.
So you have two or three cells to look at from a film, do you?
Yes, it's a little souvenir as you leave. But no, it's good. And so they've an amazing film library as well. If you ever go there just for free, you can go in and they've got lots of stuff that you can't get at online because they can't get the license for it, but you can view all sorts of stuff in little watching booths, you know, like headphones, and you can just choose whatever.
It's nice.
Quite impressive. Just if you're ever on the South Bank.
Yeah.
Top tip. So anyway, sorry, Void, do carry on.
Like Heart of Hobart, potentially, six letters. Well, I looked at this clue and thought, Heart of, I know what that's doing. That's very commonly an indicator to look at the middle letter or middle two letters of a word. So Heart of Hobart, that's B-A, clearly. So that left me with like at the start of the clue or potentially at the end of the clue as the definition. And I couldn't get an answer. So I left it, went and looked at some other clues, came back, and then immediately noticed that I could split the clue differently because I think we've mentioned before that potentially can be an anagram indicator. So it was an anagram of Hobart, which left the definition of like heart to give the answer of a throb, which is a pleasing word and a nice clue as well, a very short and succinct clue.
Yes, indeed.
Quiz clock.
So, for the first question, I've looked at three entries, Infirmly, Ailing and Peter Pan, and I came up with, Peter Pan syndrome, which is, as we all know, is the sort of psychological disorder, describes the reluctance to grow up and sort of take responsibility and act like an adult. Leading on to that, my question is, which of these literary characters does not have a psychological syndrome or complex named after them? I'm going to start off easy. Oedipus, Baron von Munchausen, Huckleberry Finn, Dorian Gray, Puss in Boots, Alice in Wonderland, or Bambi. There's just one of them is, out of those, believe it or not, does not have some sort of complex or syndrome named after them.
Okay, well, we can cross off Oedipus because we talked about him in episode 4, I think it was.
We can cross off Munchausen.
Yeah.
What was next?
You're left with Huckleberry Finn, Dorian Gray.
I think there's a Dorian Gray syndrome. I'm not sure, but I think I'm going to cross him off.
Seems plausible.
You are correct. Excessive preoccupation with your appearance, Dorian Gray.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
So who else did I have? Huckleberry Finn, Puss in Boots, Alice in Wonderland and Bambi.
Okay, well, I think there's an Alice in Wonderland syndrome. I think it's maybe
There is an Alice in Wonderland. Size perception.
Size perception, yeah.
Absolutely.
Puss in Boots talked about him in the last episode.
I'm trying to imagine what Bambi syndrome might be, kind of being, I don't know.
Being orphaned?
I was going to say distressed by the loss of a parent. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I feel like it's unfair to call that a psychological. You are right, Bambi is actually a complex where you see animals as part of the family. I thought, surely all of us who have cats or dogs see them as part of the family. Maybe over-sentimentalising
it. It's that horrible phrase, fur babies, isn't it?
Is really pretty awful. You're right. So you're left with Huckleberry Finn or Puss in Boots. Which one of those is the ringer?
I'm tempted to go with Huck, but I just on the ground, so I can't see what it might be.
I don't know. I'm going to go the other way. I'm going to go with Puss in Boots because I think I have read Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer. It's been a while. I think Huckleberry Finn had a tendency to run away from troubles or try and pretend he was something else.
You are
something like that.
Absolutely right. Huckleberry Finn syndrome is shirking duty, running away from your responsibilities. And Puss in Boots, I have to tell you, the ones which I've said, I've got sort of like more proper things, but so many. Like Little Red Riding Hood, there was at least one paper where someone had done a syndrome about them. But Puss in Boots, no, Puss in Boots does not have a syndrome named after him. So well done, you narrowed it down.
Oh, well done.
Okay, and go back to Baron von Munchausen. What did Peter Pan, Munchausen, and cats have in common? I'll be very specific. Peter Pan, 2003.
Is there a capital C on cats as you're pronouncing it there?
Cats, as in the entry here, the musical Cats, Peter Pan, and The Adventures of Baron von Munchausen.
They've all been films.
They have, and Peter Pan has obviously been filmed many times. I am specifically talking about the 2003 Jason Isaacs one.
Did they all have a character recast?
Not
I'm thinking that Munchausen had a lot of trouble getting going. Was it a Gilliam film?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, it's not about the cast. It's more bottom line than that.
Did they lose massive amounts of money?
They all lost massive amounts of money. I went into a whole Google hole of looking which the biggest flops were of all time. And one of the things I found really weird is the original Dr. Dolittle lost quite a lot of money. And then, of course, they made it again as Dolittle and lost even more money. It's just like, that's possible. I mean, it won Oscars, which we're going to get to, Oscars for best song, I think, or one Oscar for best song, but it didn't make any money. It lost about 11 million.
There was certainly a very, very recent one. Was it Robert Downey Jr., I think, in a very recent one? That just sank without trace, didn't it, that one?
Absolutely tanked as well. Yeah, no, that's quite high up on the biggest losses. But going back to Cats and Oscar winners, I wonder if you can tell me how many Oscar winners were involved in the film version of Cats?
Well, Judi Dench was, for starters.
Yeah, Judi Dench.
I've managed to remain reasonably blissfully ignorant of the film version of Cats.
Yeah.
Oh, you're really missing out.
I have a horrible...
You have to watch, but with your hands...
Suspicion. I think James Corden was in it, but he's not one of the Oscars, thankfully.
No.
No.
You've sadly already said you don't like musicals, so you're unlikely to watch the one renowned as the worst film version of musical ever.
Is Zellweger in it?
I'm sure I've done a clue somewhere for Cats where it was something about cast acts badly.
Okay, so you're not going to get this one. I mean, this amazing cast. There's Taylor Swift was in it. Idris Elba was in it.
Don't think either of those two have won an Oscar.
Ray Winston was in it.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, it was an amazing cast. So you're not going to know the answer to this because it's a terrible film. And you didn't have that car crash desire where you have to sometimes just look at the wreck, even though you're rubbernecking at it. So I can tell you that Judi Dench, obviously you got. Also, Jennifer Hudson was in it.
Okay.
She's an Oscar winner. Tom Hooper, who directed, also Academy Award winner. And of course, you should have known Andrew Lloyd Webber. I think you could say he was involved in it. I mean, not... He did write it.
Right, Didn't he make some vague disparaging comments about the film version? Am I imagining that?
Anyone who saw it could not have said anything other than, I suppose, the best you could have done was, oh, extraordinary. Wow.
You were great in that.
All those theatrical euphemisms like, well, you've done it again.
Yeah.
Yes, it's this. I was going through IMDb and checking everyone's awards, but then I found out there were 968 visual effects people on it. And that's when I thought, if they've ever been involved in Academy Awards, I've got to draw the line here. I've got other things I need to do. There's, you know, just going to sleep.
Cast members is fair enough.
Yes. Anyway. Last question, since this was a puzzle all about musicals, I'm going to ask which non-animated musical has made the most money? This is not being adjusted for inflation at this point. So which, do you know which cartoon is the best, most profitable musical?
Lion King?
It is The Lion King. Live action film?
You say not adjusted for inflation.
Not adjusted for inflation. I might ask you afterwards if it is.
Mamma Mia?
No.
Mary Poppins?
No, that's too old. Once you adjust it from inflation, they go up. But
yeah, things like Mary Poppins.
Relatively.
The sound and music are going to go up.
Oh, right. Absolute values. Singing in the Rain?
No, that's
too old, though.
Too old. Give us a clue.
Or a decade.
Probably has the words Mamma Mia in it.
Oh.
Oh. Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, that's the highest of the... I was going to say which isn't Disney, but I didn't check whether Disney made Bohemian Rhapsody.
I know what you mean.
So many things are made by Disney or owned by Disney these days.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure you can guess what the top musical is if you do adjust for inflation. No.
Chicago? No.
Chicago? You mean with Catherine Zeta-Jones? And
I don't know. It won Oscars, didn't it?
It might have done. But obviously, adjusted for inflation, I mean, it's going to be a much older one and probably, I think, the most successful musical. I really love
Siegfried Follies of 1936.
Right? No! The Sound of Music.
The Sound of Music, yeah. I did mention
you
that.
See,
yeah,
I'm sorry. I love musicals and you two, obviously, it's not your big thing. Anyway, so, you know, in the past, you've known the answers to everything, and I've just hit on a little blank spot.
That's fair enough.
I have got the original, I think it was 1956, Sound of Music, sound album. Yeah, it was my parents.
Yeah. So, I mean, I suppose it's just still so popular, I think.
Yeah.
Okay,
that's about it for this episode. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe from wherever you get your podcasts. Show notes, as always, are at offgrid.tlmb.net. You can say hi to us on the interwebs. I'm at Skirwingle on various sites.
And I'm at The Void TLMB. And if you like, you can find a cricket-themed puzzle as well as a monthly blog puzzle for March on tlmb.net/blog. General, what would you like to recommend to the listener this time around?
I would like to recommend a YouTube site called Kurzgesagt. I'm going to spell it. K-U-R-Z-G-E-S-A-G-T. It's German. And it's where my children found out about the Fermi paradox. It does, in a nutshell, little cartoon videos about black holes, probably a lot of stuff about time travel, all sorts of interesting things with cartoon ducks explaining quite complex physics things.
And science phenomena.
Science communication. Okay.
Obviously, no one's actually paying me to do this. I'm just recommending it because it's pretty cool.
Excellent.
And the duck's quite cute.
Good, great. We'll stick a link to it in the blog when we've got it.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, I guess we'll see you next time, folks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Off Grid is a TLMB production. Thank you to Picarine and The Guardian for the crossword. Our theme tune is beamed in via the aerials and roofs by thetrudy.co.uk. Check them out. If you happen to listen to us using the Overcast app, press the star button. Go on, it's right there. Thanks. And thanks to everyone who's done likewise on Spotify and any other platform. Your reviews, ratings and comments are the only payment we get for this, so everyone is hugely appreciated. Thanks. See you next time. Bye.
Really going off topic. Sorry, Void. Please tell me about the clue. I will stop talking. I'm so sorry.
It's all right. Off topic is very much our genre.